an historic meeting in the DMZ on the Korean Peninsula, and now a waiting game.
What we all know is that it can't be settled just between the two Koreas. This is where the U.S. needs to come in, because ultimately this needs to be settled between North Korea and the U.S.
Also, EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt hauled before Congress to answer for alleged ethics violations. And a new law designed to curb human trafficking on the internet passed with broad support. Why the bill worries sex workers.
The internet opened up a passage to being able to have control over what you're doing for survival.
This is The Takeaway for Friday, April 27th, 2018.
For the two Koreas to come together and to hold hands together. And we have long waited for this moment to happen, all of us. And since, as I stand here today, I can see that South and North Koreas are the same people, the same blood, that they cannot be separated together. We are the compatriots, and it has really brought strong emotions to myself as well.
North Korean President Kim Jong-un speaking through a translator there about the agreement to rid the Korean Peninsula of nuclear weapons and a promise to pursue talks to end the state of war between North and South Korea. A carefully choreographed show of diplomacy, but still some lofty goals at a summit between the leaders of North and South Korea today. Scripted to be sure, but the day did have some meaningful moments. For the first time, a North Korean leader crossed the country's southern border today as Kim Jong-un met with South Korean President Moon Jae-in in the demilitarized zone between the two countries. Jonathan Cheng attended the summit today. He's Seoul bureau chief for The Wall Street Journal.
Well, this isn't the first time that the two Korean leaders have met. There have been two previous inter-Korean summits in 2000 and 2007, but those took place in Pyongyang. This is the first time it happened, actually technically on the south side of the demilitarized zone. So for the first time in history, a North Korean leader has stepped into South Korea, technically, although, you know, just by a few feet.
So just by a few feet, and those few feet, I mean, given the state of war that's existed for 65 years between these two countries, that symbolism is fairly significant.
Yeah, no, I don't want to minimize this at all. This is a pretty big deal. And of course, this is a new leader. The previous summits were held with Kim Jong-il, the father of Kim Jong-un. But of course, Kim Jong-un's in charge now. He's in his mid-30s. We don't know exactly how old he is. But he is someone who just a few years ago, people were wondering whether he really had a grip on power, whether he really knew what he was doing. And I think what he's shown us in the last couple of months is that he's very much in control. And he's a very wily guy. He has managed to play off all of his neighbors, including some of the world's big powers. And, you know, this, of course, is just a setup for his ultimate summit meeting with Donald Trump. So things are moving much more quickly than anyone really could have expected. And today was very much in that vein. It was full of surprises, even though it was a very, very carefully scripted summit.
Now let's talk about that. Jonathan Cheng, there's some news out of this summit already, maybe even bigger news than a lot of analysts expected. What have these two sides agreed to here?
Well, so they basically agreed to move towards a peace treaty to replace the armistice that ended the Korean War in the 1950s. The Korean War ended in 1953, but it didn't formally end. They sort of signed a ceasefire, and then the ceasefire just sort of stood in place. And so this has been a big priority for the South Korean president, Moon Jae-in, who took over last year. And that's what they signed. They basically said, we want to move towards that. Now, the two Koreas couldn't just do it by themselves. And that's because the armistice in 1953 was signed by China. It was signed by the U.S. representing the U.N. and by North Korea. So those parties would have to be involved. And what they agreed to today is that the two Koreas are going to set up either a three-party talk involving the U.S. or even get China involved and move towards signing that peace treaty. They also talked about resuming family reunions, which is something that's very important emotionally to both Koreas. They talked about opening a new liaison office in North Korea so that the two Koreas can talk all the time. They talked about all sorts of these sorts of symbolic measures to try and dial down the tension, establish peace, improve relations, and most importantly for the U.S., they used the word denuclearization, and that's the most important one for the U.S. because without that, North Korea would basically remain a nuclear state, and that would be something that that most people in Washington just don't want to see.
Now, talk about that goal and what has actually been agreed to now. You say denuclearization. What does North Korea put on the table?
Well, today all they have said is they've said we share the common goal of the eventual denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. And that sounds pretty good. But a lot of people in the U.S. Who have talked a lot with North Korea, what they would point out is that that phrase, the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, means North Korea, yes, but it also means South Korea. Now, South Korea doesn't have nuclear weapons, but it does have 28,500 U.S. troops that often work with nuclear submarines, and occasionally you have B-1 bombers and B-2 bombers. And this to North Korea is what they mean, say these skeptics. And so when the North and the South agree today to say, you know, denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, what it means is maybe we in Pyongyang will give up our nuclear weapons, but only after the U.S. leaves and only after the U.S. does X, Y, and Z. And we don't really know what that means exactly. So, you know, it's vague. As many skeptics would again point out, nothing that the North has done so far is irreversible. They said earlier this month, they said, we're not going to ever launch any long-range missiles. We're not going to test any nuclear devices, but that doesn't cover shorter-range missiles. It doesn't preclude them from conducting nuclear tests in the atmosphere, which they've long been, you know, feared to be doing. It does give them a little bit of wiggle room. And what they have done in the past with a lot of these pledges is to say, well, what the U.S. has done is offensive, and therefore we need to resume starting, you know, tests again. So basically, there's still room for skepticism, but even the optimist here will say, look, this isn't a done deal. This is in some sense a setup for that Trump-Kim summit. And so it sort of lays the foundation here. The table's been set, but the question now is, can Kim and Trump close the deal together?
Jonathan Chang is Seoul Bureau Chief for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Well, let's get a view now from someone who's seen moments like this before from the inside. Ambassador Christopher Hill was a four-time ambassador, was chief negotiator from 2005 to 2009 with North Korea during the six-party talks, which were aimed at ending North Korea's nuclear program. He's currently with the University of Denver. Ambassador Hill, thanks for coming back on The Takeaway.
My pleasure.
Well, Ambassador, give us your reaction to all the pomp and circumstance, but the substance of this summit today.
Well, I think you'd have to be a complete curmudgeon not to acknowledge that this is a huge day, maybe even a historic day. I mean, the sight of the North Korean president and the South Korean president walking amidst these Chosun Dynasty dressed Korean soldiers, it was quite extraordinary. Now, of course, the question in all these summits is what's going to be the follow-up. And there are a lot of questions here, starting with the issue of denuclearization, but even the peace treaty that they spoke about. I mean, after all, the Chinese are signatories to that, as is the United States. So there needs to be a lot of choreography at a minimum before that's all done. But I mean, what a great start, and what a tribute to the efforts to prepare this summit so that they would have this outcome even before the summit began.
Now, Jonathan Chang spoke about the table being set for the more important talks between Kim Jong-un and our own President Donald Trump. Chris Hill, talk about what that table looks like realistically for a diplomat like you.
Well, I must say, when I was doing this for 4 years during the administration of George W. Bush, we never got close to the notion that George W. Bush was going to meet with Kim Jong-il. I mean, I wouldn't have lasted very long if I had made that suggestion in Washington. So this is amazing that our president has just said, sure, I'll go meet him. But the problem is in precisely the table setting. What are they going to talk about? Is there going to be a joint communique? Is there going to be an agreement on what denuclearization would look like? The president has talked about the issue of suspending tests, which is nice, but that's hardly worthy of having a presidential meeting. So I think it will inevitably come down to denuclearization. And then we have to get an idea, what is the time frame? Because the North Koreans have been a little coy about saying the time frame. I mean, do they mean in a sort of biblical sense that it'll happen when the lions lie down with the lambs? Or do they mean that they're prepared to do it in some identifiable time frame with some understandable or some clear guidelines on what they expect from us? So in the past, they've accepted the idea of denuclearization. They've accepted the idea of returning to the Non-Proliferation Treaty. reasonable amount of time, and that was something we agreed with them in 2005. But then the problem came up. We never got a declaration of what precisely their nuclear programs were, nor did we get any verification protocol worthy of the name. So there are a lot of problems here, which makes a lot of people skeptical. But I think we have to remember the historic nature of this, the fact that the Korean people have been divided since 1945 through no fault of their own. And so this is a big deal for them. And I think as Americans, we need to be careful not to seem to be sort of throwing cold water on the whole thing.
Complicated and delicate, to be sure, for the next steps. Ambassador, I want to talk about President Trump and how he's approaching these upcoming talks. Of course, the president has said, I might walk away from the talks if they're not productive. He's also been careful to praise Kim Jong-un going into the talks, setting a warm tone. But he's also famously impatient with intelligence briefings, the president's daily brief and the rest of it. Can you give a sense of how American experts from the Korea desk, from the CIA, from the National Security Advisors, the State Department, all of the people tasked with preparing President Trump for these very delicate talks are going about talking to him, the information they're giving him, and what that preparation looks like? Because it's important.
Clearly, one of the great attributes of Mike Pompeo, who's in the last 24 hours has been confirmed as Secretary of State, was his capacity to brief the president in a way that the president was pleased and felt he was getting the information he needed. The president has famously indicated he's not interested in reading lengthy briefing books or in listening to lengthy briefs. But somehow Mike Pompeo has been able to get through to him on this. So I would assume he will continue to be the sort of main person to make the president understand some of these things. And the president has spoken several times about the failed past. Well, I think it behooves him to understand what went on before and what are the kinds of formulations the North Koreans have used before, so we know what the to ask for. I think it's important to get his national security advisor, who last time I checked was someone named John Bolton, who has famously been opposed to any and all negotiations with the North Koreans. I'd like to see an effort to get him in and see what he thinks here, because what we really need is for the president to have a draft joint communique, something the Koreans obviously did for their summit, to have the president have a draft joint communique so that even before they sit down, they know there's going to be a success. And so I haven't seen that kind of preparation, of course, with the exception of Mike Pompeo going to Pyongyang, but we don't know to what extent he dealt with kind of sitting down and wordsmithing a communique.
And we've seen several incidents in the past where, for instance, Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, has not been on the same page with the president when it came not only to negotiating in North Korea, but negotiating in the Middle East with the United Arab Emirates and other countries like that. So getting this administration on one page before they can get on one page with the North Koreans seems to me like it's going to be important as well. Ambassador Chris Hill now with the University of Denver. Ambassador, we always appreciate you taking the time. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
You're listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If you like what you're hearing, give us a rating and review us on iTunes. It helps us in ways you can't imagine. Also, tell your friends. Share this podcast on Facebook or Twitter or wherever you want your followers to get some solid news coverage. They'll be smarter and they'll think you're a hero. It's a win-win. All right, now back to the show.
American comedy legend Bill Cosby is guilty. Jurors, after 14 hours of deliberations, convicted Bill Cosby on 3 counts of aggravated indecent assault against Andrea Constand. Graham Boley is an investigative reporter for the New York Times. He's been watching this case every step of the way. Graham, welcome.
Hi, Todd. Good to be here.
Well, explain, Graham, if you would, exactly what Bill Cosby was convicted of on Thursday.
3 charges of aggravated indecent assault, and he was found guilty on all 3 charges, which was penetration without consent, penetration while unconscious, and penetration after administering an intoxicant. And one by one, the jurors stood up and found him guilty of all 3.
And take us to the moment when the verdict was delivered, Graham, because it's been a long, long road getting to conviction for an extremely famous man.
It's been 14 years since he assaulted Andrea Constant in his home not far from here, where I'm sitting in Pennsylvania. And Andrea Constant was in the room for the verdict, Bill Cosby, of course. And the jury came back on the second day, yesterday, I think more quickly than anybody had expected, or we'd expected at least. Very tense, and it was very quiet. And when the jury gave their verdict, it remained very quiet, apart from some of the other women accusers who were in court, who'd been in court every day. They cheered, and then they left the courtroom, and then everybody else remained very quiet, including Andrea Constant, including Bill Cosby. And then everybody stood up at the front, and the DA started to push very strongly for maybe raising the bail, maybe not letting Mr. Cosby leave on bail. And he made the point that this was a man of a very wealthy man with lots of means, and even had a plane. And at that point, Mr. Cosby spoke out and swore at the DA and protested that he didn't have a private plane. And the judge had to calm him down.
Well, Graham, a different jury was unable to reach a verdict last summer, the first time that Bill Cosby was on trial for assaulting Ms. Constand. What made the outcome of this case different from the last time?
I think there were three big elements that were different. It was a different trial. I mean, it was the same courthouse, the same judge, the same charges, the same Bill Cosby. But there were three big elements that were different. One was the defense brought a much stronger and aggressive story, and maybe they overplayed it. They had this star witness that said Andrea Constant had made it all up. And they told this very stark story that she was the predator who'd gone after Mr. Cosby for the money. It was very aggressive, and perhaps it backfired in front of this jury. The prosecution, on its part, was able to bring five other accusers, five other women who said they'd been assaulted by Mr. Cosby in separate incidents, mainly in the 1980s. And in the first week of the trial, they got up one by one, day after day, and it was that powerful drumbeat of accounts, of patterns, similar patterns, which I think made a really big difference. And the third thing that happened was different was Me Too. This is the first high-profile trial. This was the first high-profile sexual assault trial since the Me Too movement began. And we were watching to see what effect it would have on the judge. And I think the judge let in five women. Only one woman was allowed to testify at the last trial. This time, five. We don't know why. He never gave a reason, but Me Too has happened since. Here was these five women. It was certainly a Me Too moment for the trial. And then we wanted to see what effect it would have on the jury. And, you know, they came back with this very strong verdict.
And what about the forum for the rest of Bill Cosby's life? He's 80 years old, but this is three felony counts that he's now guilty of. What kind of sentence might he realistically get?
The judge talked about this yesterday, and there's going to be a sentencing hearing in the next, within 2 months, 2 or 3 months. So he's on bail. The judge did let him leave on bail. He's confined to his home here in Philadelphia or near Philadelphia. And each of these counts, when the sentencing happens, carries a maximum of 10 years. So he could be sentenced for 30 years, but the judge talked about, you know, running them concurrently or merging some of the charges. But it's he's going to get significant jail time by the sound of it.
Graham Boley, investigative reporter with the New York Times. Graham, thank you.
Thanks, Todd.
Thanks for being with us on The Takeaway today. I'm Todd Zwillick. As authorities in Toronto continue to investigate the suspect in the deadly van attack that killed 10 people, more attention now has been drawn to the involuntary celibate or incel community. The suspect in that attack, Alec Manassian, allegedly posted on his Facebook page about an incel rebellion moments before the attack. Now, authorities have not made a connection between that Facebook post and Manassian's alleged role in the attack, but it has raised the profile of the incel community. Reporter and correspondent Jack Smith IV covers extremism for Mike, and he explained the online incel community on this show yesterday.
It is men who believe that they have been deprived of women's intimacy, perhaps intentionally, and that deprivation, their inability to essentially have sex with women, has been an assault on their self-esteem, their sense of status, and consequently their self-worth, and then harbor an enormous amount of resentment towards women for that alleged disenfranchisement.
Well, we wanted to talk to someone who used to consider themselves part of the incel community, but has since left. So we put out a call on the social media site Reddit, where a lot of incel conversations take place. And Jeff Scott responded. He's 20 years old. He's a college student in West Virginia. And he says he was once a member of the incel community online until getting out a couple of years ago. Jeff Scott, thanks for being here.
Well, thanks for having me, Todd.
Jeff, you hear Jack Smith IV describing the incel community there in the intro. Do you hear yourself in what he's saying?
I hear myself a couple of years ago, not anymore, thankfully.
And talk about that. You hear yourself a couple years ago. Jack Smith IV talks about men online feeling deprived of women's intimacy. They blame women for that, for their inability to have sex, and essentially turn this resentment toward women because they feel like they've been cut off. To talk about how you felt.
Well, essentially at the time, I was 14, so I was probably younger than your average member of the incel community. A lot of these guys are in their early 20s to upwards of early 40s. That's the oldest I've seen. Honestly, the basic feeling is that you are deprived of something that you deserve. And the people depriving you of this are these women, and they're at fault for depriving you of it. And I mean, I think it's just this entitlement that really fuels the incel community more than anything else.
Now, you said you were 14 at the time when you first got involved. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Well, that's around middle school. I guess that's the eighth or ninth grade. Can be kind of a tough time for any kid. But how are you feeling personally at the time? Do you remember what about these ugly online postings attracted you?
Essentially, it was just a sense of isolation that I felt. And it's not a good feeling. It makes you feel cut off. It makes you feel pretty much worthless. And these other people that are also feeling isolated, we almost bonded in our isolation from our peers. And in that way, we kind of overcame our isolation. Unfortunately, it was with some rather unkempt beliefs, but yeah, I mean, I think that everyone feels kind of lonely at 14, but I feel like the internet allows us to connect now, or allows impressionable, you know, teenagers to connect with sources that are perhaps more unsavory than, you know, a 14-year-old needs to be connecting with.
Now, at 14, you may not have known what a misogynist was, but you know now because you're a little bit older. Looking back on yourself at that age, do you think you did hate women, or do you know why?
I don't think I hated women in the same way that someone like Elliot Rodgers or this Toronto attack hated them, so much as I just felt a lot of anger and resentment towards them. Why is honestly just because I wasn't getting attention from them. I just wasn't the type of person at the time that women wanted to be around. Instead of blaming myself, I blamed them.
Did you ever see or hear anyone in that community, though, talking about real-world violence rather than just talking about it online, talking about actually committing a violent act?
There were some people that talked about, like, the desire to commit violent acts. As best I could tell, there's no one that really talked. I mean, if you go out and perform a massacre, or even if you, you know, perform rape, that's not something that I think most people in the community are going to accept. I mean, it depends, like, because these people are very worried, too, that they're going to be, you know, found out. Like, advocating for violence is a crime. And I know after the San Bernardino, a lot of people, including myself, got out of there as quick as we could, scrubbed our accounts because we wanted no association with that type of violence.
Now, Jeff, I want to talk about that moment that you decided to get out after the Isla Vista attack. I understand that maybe you didn't feel violent, you didn't want to be participating with people who did. But what about your own feelings toward women? Did you feel like those changed? Do you feel like they've changed today?
Yeah, I mean, I've had girlfriends since then. I mean, I've gotten laid more than a couple times. I mean, I just see them more as people that, you know, they don't have anything to withhold. They are people that, you know, like, they like to have sex, just like men like to have sex. And, you know, like, and these incels, too, they're not trying to go after women that, you know, aren't necessarily the most attractive mates. They're trying to go after, you know, like, supermodels, and they think they deserve them. Like, I would bet you anything there's incels that, you know, have had plenty of opportunities with maybe less than attractive partners that just actively chose not to pursue them.
Well, let's leave sex aside for just a second and just talk about your relationships with women at school or your teachers or your friends or your peers. What are your relationships like with those women in your life?
Now or back then?
Let's talk about now.
Yeah, everything's pretty much fine. I mean, I just kind of view people as people. I have female friends. I mean, I don't disrespect anyone for their gender, their race, anything like that. I mean, everyone just is trying to do the best they can with what they got.
Jeff, have you ever talked to a woman in your life, a friend or someone you know, about this online community and how you felt when you were younger? Have you ever confided in a friend who's a woman about those feelings?
Yeah. I've talked to previous girlfriends, a couple friends about it. And a lot of them just chalked it up to being 14. It's just something that, you know, growing up, you try out a lot of different cultures. You try out a lot of different mindsets. And thankfully, I rejected that particular one.
When you talk to women about it, tell me what they said. Tell me what happened when you talked to a former girlfriend about it.
I mean, she wasn't exactly ecstatic, but she just, you know, she recognized that it was something that I was part of years ago. And even like the first girl that I met after I kind of ended my interaction with this a few months afterwards, she didn't care. I mean, she knew who I was as a person, and we liked each other for that.
Jeff Scott, college student in West Virginia, once a member when he was younger of the incel community. Jeff, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
This month, President Trump signed the Allow States and Victims to Fight Online Sex Trafficking Act, commonly known as FOSTA. It's designed to crack down on sex trafficking of minors. The bill got overwhelming support in Congress. Here's Missouri Republican Congresswoman Ann Wagner, who sponsored it.
If activity is illegal and criminal offline, it should be criminal and illegal online. And Backpage and hundreds of other websites were hiding behind the immunity clauses right in the Communications Decency Act, and we're getting off scot-free. They were selling our women and our children.
Now, FOSTA is supposed to crack down on online sex trafficking by making internet companies responsible for illegal content. But while the intent is admirable, some sex workers and their advocates say it punishes them in the process.
The internet has been one of the main tools that law enforcement has used to find trafficked people and to prosecute them. So it's a positive for law enforcement in terms of real trafficking cases. And by trafficking, I mean people who are forced to work under force, fraud, or coercion, which is very different from people who choose sex work and who do it of their own free will.
That is Crystal DuBois, co-executive director of the SOAR Institute, an advocacy group for sex workers and survivors of human trafficking. She says the problem with FOSTA is that it drives sex work underground, making it far more dangerous. Well, I sat down with Crystal and also with Kyan Dorishow, the founder of GLITS, that's Gays and Lesbians Living in a Transgender Society. Kyan works with sex workers, and she's a trans woman and a former sex worker herself. And Kyan says FOSTA is especially dangerous for trans women. But as Crystal explains, the internet made voluntary sex work safer.
When sex work moved onto the internet, it actually created a lot of safety mechanisms. For instance, homicides went down by 17%, and this is often allocated to the move of sex work off the streets and onto the internet. The internet allows sex workers to screen people before they meet them. It allows a digital trail of a date so that they can be identified if there was a bad date or a violent client. And it allows the coworkers of sex workers to know where a person is, to be in communication with the person, to know how long they're expected to be gone. So there are a lot of ways that the internet has made sex work safer.
Kyan Dorishow, you're an advocate for sex workers now. Does what Crystal is saying make sense to you? Did the internet allow sex work to be safer for people who you know and who you represent?
Because of the internet, my clients literally got to not only have security, but have a base where they were protected by how they screened opposed to street work. I can't tell you how many hotels and alleys and death scenes I was called in on because there wasn't anything to protect us. The internet kind of opened up a passage to being able to have control over what you're doing for survival.
Cayenne, we've heard news recently that the personal section of Craigslist has been shut down, famously now Backpage.com shut down. What if people said to you, the people who you represent, who you advocate for, what have they said about the effect on their work and their lives now that this bill is on the books?
I've had the misfortune to just put a girl into psychiatric care. I've had panic, sheer panic. I've had at least 20 or 30 people tell me that they're about to be evicted. I am blessed to have the life that I have, but not every trans woman has the life that I have, because corporate America is not going to hire us. So how could you take away something that actually kept people off the street, that actually gave somebody a home? We're hearing these large numbers of trafficking has nothing to do with probably sex workers at all.
That, Todd, can I just jump in and mention that there's a lot of discussion around this act in terms of human trafficking. And if we want to fight human trafficking, we have to fight the underlying conditions of human trafficking. And when that's international trafficking, it can be LGBT people fleeing their home country because their identity is criminalized there, arriving into the United States without work documents or the availability to work could mean being vulnerable to trafficking. What we see are teenagers who are kicked out of their house for being gay or for other reasons and then become vulnerable to traffickers to survive. And so if we want to talk about human trafficking in a real way, it's not by passing acts that further criminalize people and make websites that are helping people shut down and self-censor. It's by creating conditions in which people can thrive. There are a lot of underlying conditions that we can look at if we want to fight trafficking, but this act doesn't do that.
So, Cayenne, I want you to imagine if FOSTA had been passed during that time when you were doing sex work and I assume advertising on the internet, maybe a different internet than we have today, different websites and everything else. But if that law had passed and you weren't able to do any of your advertising or your tracking on the internet, what would that have done to your life or to the safety that you could enjoy at least while doing sex work?
If it would have happened at that time, you would have annihilated the whole trans community. Because at this present day, there is a trans woman dying around the world every day that's not even related to sex work. So you put trans women back in the street. Imagine if this happened back then. Imagine how you could literally take out a whole nation of people.
Crystal, when this bill was being debated and ultimately passed, I saw an awful lot of argument, debate between tech companies about a free internet, about free speech, and everything else sort of at the corporate level. I confess I didn't see a whole lot of debate or discussion along the lines of what you and Cayenne are advocating for here. I didn't hear anyone in Washington, or at least not very many people, talking about whether driving this type of advertisement, whether this type of work further underground was really a good idea for people.
Politicians very much want to appear as though they are fighting human trafficking, even though they aren't invested in pragmatic solutions to human trafficking. So it doesn't surprise me at all that politicians didn't debate at the granular level that they would debate other things. It does surprise me that the tech industry ended up not fighting this bill as hard as they should have, because it will fundamentally change the way the internet functions. It is the first step of
censorship.
The first step of censorship, the first step of taking apart some internet freedoms. And it's you know, not surprising to me that human trafficking was the Trojan horse used to do that. I think that we're going to see ripple effects for a long time and that slowly it will hit us.
Crystal DuBois is co-executive director of the Charmis Outlaw Advocacy and Rights Group. Crystal, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And Cayenne Dorashow, thanks to you as well. Cayenne is founder of GLITS, Gays and Lesbians Living in Transgendered Society. Thank you so much, Cayenne.
Thank you.
I'm here to talk to you about the Avenger Initiative.
Hey, man. We're about to jump on that ginormous spaceship. You want to come?
Anybody ever tell you you're a little paranoid?
Not to my face. Why? Did you hear something?
I'm getting revenge. You're getting revenge.
Seriously?
You gotta clean up your room. It's a complete mess.
I am Groot.
I am Iron Man.
Everyone up here versus everyone down there.
This is your legacy.
Did he freeze?
Like an antelope in headlights.
Are you finished?
Puny God.
All Avengers all the time. Hulk, don't be angry. It's Avengers time. It's Infinity War. Rafer Guzman is here, film critic for Newsday and for us here at The Takeaway. Hey, Rafer.
Hey, Todd.
We are sticking with Avengers Infinity War. This is exciting. I am a recent convert to this franchise, Rafer. I want to tell you. So in the past, if I've dissed the comic book movies, and I know I have, I'm down with this. I want you to know off the top.
All right. Listen, you and me both. I've also sort of been a little up and down about the Marvel movies.
Well, we're going to get into it. We're going to get into Infinity War. Of course, I have trivia for you, Rafer, here. I have Avengers trivia, if you like. And I'm going to ask you to listen to this clip and think about Captain America. Here's Captain America talking about his shield. Now, Rafer's going to hold on to his answer. And if you know it, hit me on Twitter. We're going to come back to the answer at the end. Listen.
It's stronger than steel and a third the weight. It's completely vibration absorbent.
How come it's not a standard issue?
That's the rarest metal on Earth. What you're holding there, that's all we've got.
Rafer, that's Captain America. Now, here's my question for you. Where would Captain America need to go to find a replacement shield if he lost the shield he had? And I got a bonus question for you as well. What is that shield made of? Where would he have to go to get it replaced? What's it made of? I think you probably know the answer. Hold on to it. Rafer, let's talk Infinity War. All your friends are here. Hulk, Thor, Black Widow, Black Panther, they're all here. Go for it.
This is pretty much anyone who's got a suit or a secret name is here in this film. And of course, what's the one thing that could bring all these people together? A villain, of course. A film is really only as good as its villain. And this time you've got a guy named Thanos who is searching for the 6 Infinity Stones that will give him the power to end half of life in the universe. He's kind of a population control guy. This is his dispassionate plan to randomly kill half the people in the universe. That's the plot for you.
So we won't do too many spoilers. Look, I sometimes worry, I'm all about Infinity War now, I sometimes worry that with all of my cartoon friends coming into one movie, it's Iron Man, it's Black Panther, it's Black Widow, it's Scarlet Witch, it's the whole gang, that it might be a bit of a mess. Do I have anything to worry about?
You know, I thought the same thing too, because, you know, they basically got to squeeze everybody but the Thundercats are in this film, right? But it's 2.5 hours long, which also, you know, that gives them the running time, but it also runs the risk of exhausting you. I have to say, Joe and Anthony Russo, the directors of this thing, do a masterful job of juggling all this stuff and making it sort of go and seem fast and quick, and you never seem too scattered, even though, of course, it's a Marvel movie and things are coming at you right and left. You know, one thing I will say that I really liked about this movie is it ends on kind of a note that I will call solemn. After all of this 2.5 hours of bombast and action and, you know, and like you say, all your favorite guys coming together, there's action, there's banter, and then everything gets very quiet, very serious. Really reminded me a lot of Empire Strikes Back, which was my favorite in the original Star Wars trilogy. Mm,
a somber, maybe perhaps moral note to look forward to after all the explosions and existential death of the Infinity War. Well, I'm looking forward to it. As I said, I'm back on board with this cartoon classic, soon to be a classic, so I'm ready for it. Now, let's go back to trivia. Rafer, I asked you a question about Captain America. I asked you where Captain America would need to go if he needed to replace his shield. Where would he have to go?
Is that Wakanda?
That is Wakanda, home of Black Panther, of course. And the Wakandans, what would they be able to provide?
Vibranium?
That's the one.
Yes.
Vibranium, the hardest element in the universe that powers Captain America's shield, and a whole lot of other things, too, in the Avengers universe. Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, thank you so much.
Rafer smash.
All right, that's all for us today. You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE, and you can always tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.